back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Jack Jacobs, Professor of Political Science at John Jay College and Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's here to talk about his new book, The Frankfurt School, Jewish Lives and Antisemitism, published in 2015 by Cambridge University Press. Professor Jacobs, thanks so much for being with us on the show.
Thank you for initiating the interview. I appreciate it, Max.
Okay, so just to get us started, could you tell us a bit about how you came to write this book?
Sure. Quite some time back, I was working on a project that had to do with the aid and support that was given by the Jewish Labor Committee to German refugees during the Nazi era. The Jewish Labor Committee was an organization that had been founded in New York in the early 1930s, and they moved heaven and earth to help people who were trapped in Europe by the rise of the Nazis. At that point in time, the papers of the Jewish Labor Committee had been given to NYU, New York University, to the Tamimint Institute, but they had not yet been arranged. They were in a vast number of cardboard cartons sitting in a back room. And so I had to go through these cartons one by one, never knowing what I was going to find. And at some point, to my shock, I discovered in one of these boxes a typescript, something like 1,500 pages long, that had been written by members of the Institute of Social Research, and that among the people involved in this typescript were none other than Theodor Adorno. I had been a student of political theory, and I knew about the Institute of Social Research, and I knew about Theodor Adorno, or at least I knew a little bit about Theodor Adorno, but I had no idea that there had been any connection whatsoever between the Institute and the Jewish Labor Committee. They came from very, very different worlds. And so I began to investigate this, even though it had virtually nothing to do with the project that I had begun. And I wrote to Leo Löwenthal, who was a member of the Frankfurt School and who was still alive at that point in time. And I wrote to Martin Jay, who had written the definitive work on the Frankfurt School. And I received encouragement from them. And so my project began in a long time ago. And it took off from there as I began to realize that in order to explain this typescript that I had found and the significance of it, I would need to talk about the history of the Frankfurt School itself and the trajectory of those who had been involved in it over a very long period of time. And that was the origin of the book.
That's great. So we'll definitely get in and tackle a bit more of that. But just for our listeners, if you could give us a little bit of an overview of what the Frankfurt School was or is, and what the Institute for Social Research is, and who are the major figures from the Frankfurt School that you're looking at in your book. You mentioned Theodor Adorno. If you could tell us a bit more.
Gladly. In the wake of the First World War, there was interest in Germany in certain circles in starting an academic entity that would have a Marxist or a leftist orientation and that would do research on issues of interest to the left from a scholarly perspective. And the university in Frankfurt, Germany, was willing to allow such a entity to be affiliated with it. And a formal institution was created that was known as the Institute of Social Research. And the Institute of Social Research, when it began in the early 1920s, was a grouping that was devoted to study of economic matters and the labor movement and the history of socialism. And there was nothing else like it in Germany. German universities were rather staid and rather conservative, and this new institute therefore proved to be attractive to individuals who couldn't easily find a place for themselves elsewhere in the German academic world. The institute was organized, it got up and running, and the initial director became ill and passed away. It was when Max Horkheimer was brought in as the new director that things began to crystallize in ways that ultimately were very important in theoretical and philosophical and political terms. Because Max Horkheimer, as the director of the Institute, grouped around him a number of people who became quite prominent over a long period of time. Initially, that is to say, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, there were five individuals who were actually working at the Institute and who had full-time associations with the Institute living in Frankfurt. At that point, Adorno was not one of them. He affiliated somewhat later. But the five, in addition to Max Horkheimer, were his lifelong friend Fritz Pollack, and Leo Löwenthal, and Erich Fromm, and Heinrich Grossmann. That is to say that this was a rather small grouping, and some of the most famous people who later affiliated with the Institute were not yet members during this period in the late Weimar period that I'm talking about right now. In addition to Adorno, who, as I've already indicated, became a member in a later period, I would also mention here from the very beginning of our discussion, Herbert Marcuse, who only became a member of the Institute when it went into exile after the beginning of the Nazi period. But when Horkheimer became director, I think that the way that I would characterize what he was up to is that he wanted to initiate large-scale projects that would combine both qualitative and quantitative approaches, large-scale projects that would try to grapple with the major political and social and philosophical questions of the day. And he eventually developed a term, he and his colleagues developed a term, critical theory, to describe the approach that they were using. As I'm certain you know, the Nazis came to power in Germany in the early 1930s, and it was necessary for Horkheimer and his colleagues to leave Germany. And luckily, they were actually rather prescient in anticipating what was going to happen. They all, that is to say, all of the individuals who I have already mentioned, succeeded in leaving Germany, and they were also able to bring the assets of the Institute out of Germany with them at a rather early point in time. And to give you an indication of the kinds of projects that they were interested in during this era, they wanted to try to figure out how had this happened? That is to say, why and how had the Nazis come to power? And why hadn't the German working class, the German proletariat, played the kind of role that an early generation of Marxists had anticipated that it would play? Why hadn't there been a successful proletarian revolution in Germany? And Horkheimer said to his colleagues, in effect, well, we're going to use a multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary approach to try to figure this out. And we'll each bring to bear our own expertise, whether that is the study of economics or the study of psychology or the study of literature or the study of philosophy. And we will, of course, work cooperatively and see if we can come to grips with this phenomenon. And I think that that was a very important example and very indicative of what it was that the Institute hoped to do and what it was that Horkheimer and Pollack and Löwenthal and Fromm and the others intended to do.
So I think we'll look at it in a second at how exactly the Frankfurt School changed their analysis, particularly of anti-Semitism, once they arrived in the United States. But before we get to that, could you tell us a bit more about the Jewish, particularly Jewish life paths of the critical theorists you look at? You say that you reject any attempt to explain critical theory through biography, but that the history of the Frankfurt School cannot fully be told unless due attention is paid to their Jewish backgrounds. So if you could tell us a bit more about what you mean by that and what those life paths of the theorists were and how they were particularly Jewish.
Well, what I would say is that it is far, far more than coincidence that literally all of the individuals who I have mentioned who were involved with the Institute of Social Research as full-time members in the late Weimar years were of Jewish origin. Horkheimer, Pollack, Löwenthal, Fromm, Grossman, these were all men of Jewish origin. And they all arrived at the Institute down what I call Jewish paths. Now, these were different paths for each of these men. But what's for me significant is that their family backgrounds, their upbringings, their interests were actually rather distinctively Jewish in a variety of different ways. The ways in which they got to the Institute were, in effect, distinctively Jewish in a variety of different ways. So perhaps if I trot very rapidly, or maybe not so rapidly, through each of these individuals, or most of them, you'll see what I have in mind. Horkheimer and Pollack both had rather testy, in some ways, but also rather typical kinds of relationships with their families, with their successful Jewish businessmen fathers. And in the case of Horkheimer, what that meant was that his turn to a leftist orientation was tied in some important ways, I think, to rejecting certain components of the way in which he had been raised and of his father's legacy. That is to say, his father, I think, had hoped when Max was young that Max would himself become a successful business person. And Max wanted nothing to do with that. And in a way that was actually rather typical for Jews of his generation, he was engaged in this push-pull with his father. The family was very explicitly Jewish. His father went to synagogue, albeit not consistently, not all the time. But Max was given something of a Jewish education. He had a bar mitzvah. His father was involved in B'nai B'rit, as were virtually all Jewish men, or many Jewish men. Virtually all is too strong. Many Jewish men in Germany in that era, and so Horkheimer grows up in this milieu where he's certainly very conscious of being Jewish, but he has this dynamic where he's rejecting some components of his parents' politics, and at the same time trying to find his own path. I could say something similar about Löwenthal, except that in Löwenthal's case, unlike in Horkheimer's, part of the rejection of or dynamic of the relationship between Löwenthal and his father was that Löwenthal became attracted to explicitly Jewish institutions at a young age. At one point, becomes religiously very observant. He becomes Shomer Shabbos. He becomes kosher. He marries a woman who is deeply involved in Jewish life. Now, ultimately, Löwenthal moves away from this explicitly positive period of his Jewishness, but there's no question at all that his involvement in Jewish institutions had a profound and lasting impact on him over a long period of time. Erich Fromm, unlike Horkheimer or Löwenthal, did not grow up in an assimilated or acculturated background. Fromm did not reject his parents' background when he was young. He grew up in a strictly Orthodox environment, and he studied traditional texts from a rather early age quite rigorously. And he was himself involved in helping to create some of the most important Jewish cultural and educational institutions of the 1920s, like the Lehrhaus, the famous Frankfurter Lehrhaus. Fromm was involved with that institution from an early age. Grossmann came from a somewhat different background because he was, as German Jews used to say, an Ostjude. He was from a more East European environment. Grossmann had grown up in the eastern part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and had become involved with the Austro-Hungarian equivalent of the Jewish Workers' Bund before he ever came to Frankfurt. Pollock, finally, of this initial group, I've already alluded to the fact that his father was a wealthy business person. Pollock was not someone who was ever explicitly, directly involved in Jewish affairs. And in fact, he rejected throughout his life the notion that Jewish matters had any significant impact on him. But I see his life path as somewhat differently than he himself saw it. And I would argue that his involvement in German leftist intellectual life is actually very similar to the involvement of countless of his German Jewish counterparts in many different, cultural and political movements. And that in this way, it's not an accident that he was attracted to the Institute of Social Research, attracted to the Horkheimer circle, we could say. This was a rather widespread phenomenon in Weimar Germany. So what I would say is, of course, the Institute of Social Research was not founded as an explicitly Jewish entity. It would be nonsense to suggest otherwise. And of course, it didn't choose its members on the basis of their background, their religiosity, their ethnicity, or anything of the kind. But when we look at who the members of the Institute were in the period that I'm focusing on right now, what we find is that these five men had an elective affinity for one another. They had an elective affinity for people who were like them. That is to say, men of a particular generational cohort who were of Jewish background, who were leftists, and who were intellectuals. And there were precious few individuals who were not Jewish who had similar elective affinities and who associated with the Institute.
So in chapter two, you examine the Frankfurt School's changing analysis of anti-Semitism, particularly as it evolved during their years of exile in the United States. Tell us a bit about the studies that were devoted to examining anti-Semitism and authoritarianism during these years, and what the relationship was between the Institute's empirical and theoretical works on anti-Semitism.
Gladly. I think that it's a significant subject, and I'm happy to talk about it. I think I'd like to begin not by talking about those studies, but rather by talking about the changes in the attitude towards anti-Semitism in the core members of the Institute during that exile period. I've already indicated that the key members of the Institute of Social Research went into exile. The individuals who I've mentioned eventually all made it to the United States at various points. Marcuse and Adorno and others also joined them in the United States. And I think it's worth pointing out that despite what I've said earlier about Horkheimer's background, Horkheimer was not a person who devoted sustained theoretical attention to the study of anti-Semitism, either in the Weimar years or in his first years in America. And indeed, there's a rather famous article that Horkheimer wrote in the late 1930s that appeared in the periodical of the Institute of Social Research, the Zeitschrift für Soziale Forschung. It's an article that's called The Jews and Europe. And it's a piece written by Horkheimer. And what's significant in that that article is that Horkheimer has what I think we could best describe as a classically Marxist perspective on the so-called Jewish question in this piece on the Jews and Europe. And, you know, what he says in the article in a few pithy phrases is, you can't speak about anti-Semitism without speaking about capitalism. You can't understand the rise of fascism without speaking about capitalism. And that, I think, is something that Marxist and Marxist-influenced theorists would have all agreed on, however many differences there were amongst them. But I think that what we find is that as the Nazis consolidated power, and as the Holocaust began, and as the situation of Jews in Europe worsened, and as the members of the Frankfurt School themselves encountered anti-Semitism in the United States, and they did encounter anti-Semitism in the United States, Horkheimer became open to thinking about anti-Semitism in a somewhat different, somewhat more multifaceted, indeed somewhat more sophisticated way. And I argue that he did so in part under Adorno's influence. That is to say that Theodor Adorno, who was himself, to use categories that I don't like, but that are pretty clear, he was himself half Jewish, that is to say, only partially of Jewish origin, and who had himself, Adorno, had attempted to remain in Europe when the other individuals I have mentioned left. Adorno thought at first when the Nazis came to power that by keeping his head low in Germany, he might be able to get away with staying in Germany and writing under an assumed name and just kind of struggle through. But that as the years went by, the years being the 1930s, Adorno had come to see that that was not going to work. and that the anti-Semitism that he was encountering in Germany was rather deeper and rather more significant than he had initially understood, and that he was himself going to be victimized by it unless he got out. And so after an interim period in England, he did get out. And Horkheimer became interested in working closely with Adorno on theoretical and philosophical projects. And when Adorno comes to the United States, Adorno has a very major impact on Horkheimer, including an impact on Horkheimer's understanding of anti-Semitism. And Adorno at one point says something along the lines of, you know, everything that we used to see from the point of view of the proletariat is now being focused on the Jews, and that we need to take this phenomenon seriously. And so the aid of other members of the Institute, including the people I've already mentioned and other recruits who are added to the roster of Institute members in the 1940s, that the Institute begins to solicit funds for and begins to conduct research on major projects devoted to an understanding of anti-Semitism. And during this exile period, the Institute is associated with two profoundly important world-famous books, I would say, that continue to be widely read today, they're very well known, I think, in the academic world. And the studies I'm thinking about are, on the one hand, Dialectic of Enlightenment, which was co-written by Horkheimer and Adorno, and on the other hand, The Authoritarian Personality, in which Adorno played a key role alongside other individuals who were not members of the Institute of Social Research. Now, the reason that I'm mentioning these two profoundly important, very, very interesting works is that if one looks at Dialectic of Enlightenment, what one finds is that the last substantive chapter is a chapter of entitled Elements of Anti-Semitism. And if one looks at The Authoritarian Personality and scratches a little bit under the surface, what one finds is that The Authoritarian Personality was actually conducted, the research for that work was conducted under the auspices of the AJC, one of the most important American Jewish organizations, and that Horkheimer was made a member of the staff of the AJC during the period when the work on The Authoritarian Personality was underway. So what I'm suggesting here is, first of all, that where anti-Semitism had not been part of the explicit research agenda of the Institute in the Weimar years or in the early exile years, during the years of the Second World War and immediately thereafter, matters related to anti-Semitism became absolutely central to the work of the Frankfurt School and of the Institute of Social Research, more broadly defined. Now, what they had to say about anti-Semitism is really, really complicated. But what I would say in a nutshell is the way in which their perspective in, let's say, Dialectic of Enlightenment differed from what Horkheimer had said in The Jews and Europe is that Horkheimer and Adorno came to see that one couldn't explain anti-Semitism using only a strict Marxist analysis or relying only on an economic explanation of the relationship of Jews to non-Jews, but that one needed to bring to bear any number of other matters. One needed to understand the religious roots of anti-Semitism. One needed to understand the psychoanalytic roots of anti-Semitism. One needed to understand the role of anti-Semitism in the development of contemporary civilization itself in order to come to grips with it. And in Dialectic of Enlightenment, in that chapter on elements of anti-Semitism that I alluded to, what Horkheimer and Adorno do is they sketch out a series of interrelated elements, all of which have to be understood as a constellation, which together explain anti-Semitism in ways that no one element possibly could. So I guess that what I would say here is anti-Semitism moves from being a matter which was not on the agenda of the Institute in the Weimar years to being the central or a central component of its research agenda in the years of the Second World War. And you'll remember that I said that when Horkheimer became director, he had from the beginning said, well, what we've got to do is we've got to combine quantitative and qualitative approaches in order to explain large social phenomena. And you asked me about the empirical studies that they had done. The empirical studies include the work that ultimately appeared in The Authoritarian Personality. And the empirical studies also include that work on anti-Semitism in the American labor movement that I had happened upon by accident in the NYU archives many years earlier. And what Horkheimer and his colleagues were trying to do was at one and the same time understand this phenomena of anti-Semitism and explain this phenomena by conducting empirical work and by doing philosophical and what I would call psychoanalytic work to explain how and why hatred of the Jews had grown to be such important, grown to have such importance. And I guess that what I argue, summing up here in that second chapter, is that the empirical studies and the more theoretically oriented studies interact with one another in what I dare say was a dialectical manner. There have been other scholars who have claimed that this didn't work. I think that it did work to a considerable degree, and that the quantitative work and the theoretical work shed light on one another, and that Horkheimer and Adorno were successful in trying to come to grips with and help us understand anti-Semitism in a sophisticated manner in ways that earlier theorists had not been.
Great. So moving on to the final chapter, you turn to an examination of key critical theorist attitudes towards Israel. Can you walk us through these differing opinions and explain how they are linked to the relationships of these men to Jewishness and Judaism?
Sure. I think that in order to understand what that chapter is doing there, why the book is structured that way, I need to say a word or two about background. I was approached by Cambridge to write a book on the Frankfurt School and Jewish matters, and I was delighted to have been asked, and I sent it back a proposal, and what I said in my initial proposal was, well, you know, the first part, I'll deal with Weimar and in ways that we've talk about the backgrounds of these people. And in the second part, I'll talk about exile and the studies that they did of anti-Semitism and the impact that these studies had on the Jewish self-identifications of the individuals involved, for lack of a better phrase. And then what I want to do, I said in my original proposal in the final part of the work, is I want to compare the work done by the members of the Frankfurt School on these issues with work done by others, work that was done by Hannah Arendt, work that was done by Sartre, how these various theorists were received both by the Jewish world and by the non-Jewish world. And when Cambridge sent out the proposal I had given to blind readers, you know, to this day, of course, I don't know who the readers were. What the readers consistently replied over and over again is, you know, this is a really interesting project and you should give Jacobs the contract and you should encourage him to go ahead. But we don't think that he should do that last part of the book here in this book. If the first part of the book is Weimar and the second part is exile, then the final part of the work should deal with the final decades of the life of the first generation of the Frankfurt School. That, you know, that there should be an arc of in effect, beginning, middle, and end. And, you know, that made a lot of sense to me. The readers, whoever they were, clearly knew what they were talking about and all had a lot of experience quite manifestly in producing successful books. And so I listened to them and I scrapped the entire projected third part of the work, which I had already done some, you know, preliminary work on, and started to think about, well, what am I going to have this last portion of the book revolve around? And as I started to do research on the lives and careers and ideas of people like Horkheimer and Löwenthal and Fromm and Marcuse in the post-war era, it came clear to me that their varying attitudes towards Israel and Zionism, particularly after the establishment of the State of Israel in 48, was extremely important in terms of understanding who these people were and in terms of understanding the differences amongst them. And so what I ultimately came up with is something like this, something counterintuitive, but I actually think worth us thinking through. And that is, in the case of the core members of what had been the Horkheimer Circle, had been the key members of the Frankfurt School interested in such matters, the more that a theorist knew about Judaism, and the more that they identified with Jewish religious doctrines, the more critical they were of Israel in this era. That is to say, in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, the final decades of their lives. And, you know, without going through the litany of the thinkers, once again, I'll give you the two poles, so to speak, on this matter. Erich Fromm, as I indicated a little bit earlier in this discussion, was raised in an Orthodox home, was rigorously observant in his childhood and adolescent years, was intimately familiar with Jewish religious texts. He ultimately secularized. He ultimately moved away from Orthodox observance, indeed from observance of any kind. But, of course, he retained his familiarity with those texts, and he retained a great deal of sympathy for specific Jewish religious doctrines throughout his life, despite the fact that he was not a believer late in life. And Fromm was the strongest critic of the State of Israel, of the members of the institute with which I'm concerned in this book. He was consistently very critical of the state, never came to grips with it, never went to visit Israel, and wrote extremely strong condemnations of the policies of Israeli governments over a long period of time. And here comes the punchline for me. And over and over and over again, what he would say in these condemnations was, in effect, the positions being taken by the state of Israel and by the government of the state of Israel are not consistent with Jewish religious doctrine. They are not consistent with Judaism. They're not consistent with what I, Fromm, was always taught to believe was Jewishness. Now, on the other side of this equation, I've mentioned Herbert Marcuse, of course, a very famous name, but I didn't talk about his background the way that I talked about the backgrounds of Horkheimer or Leventhal or Pollock or Fromm or Grossman, because Marcuse had not been involved in the Institute in Weimar. So let me say here that Marcuse came from a far, far more acculturated background than did Horkheimer or Fromm or Grossman or any number of other individuals. He did not have a strong positive Jewish identity. He did receive a minimal Jewish education, but it wasn't a matter that was of interest to him as he was growing up or in his adolescent years or in his early years as a theorist. He was certainly aware that he was Jewish. He was himself, I would argue, almost certainly a victim of anti-Semitism in the period when he was a graduate student, when he was finishing his habilitation work, for example. But it wasn't, he wasn't amongst the people who wrote on anti-Semitism as some of his colleagues did in the exile years. Now, what's interesting for me is that after the establishment of the state and in his later decades, Marcuse takes a much, I think, softer line, a much more sympathetic line on Israel than Fromm does. Marcuse is someone who was open to what today we would probably call a two-state solution. And Marcuse makes a trip to Israel, where he goes out of his way to meet with leading Israeli political figures, as well as with academics and leftists of various kinds. And it's clear that Marcuse is concerned that the anti-Semitism that had resulted in the murder of millions of Jews only decades earlier had not gone away. And he saw Israel as a place that could provide a refuge to those who had survived and maybe a refuge to other Jews if need be, if anti-Semitism was going to rear its ugly head once again, and he feared that it very well might. So to sum up what I've just said, what I try to do in that last part of the book is I sketch out the attitudes towards Israel of four figures, Horkheimer and Leventhal and Fromm and Marcuse. And what I try to show is that there was an inverse relationship there between their Judaism, or sympathy for Judaism, knowledge of Judaism, and their attitudes towards the state of Israel. The more that one knew about Judaism, however they defined that, and they didn't define that in precisely the same way down the line, the more one knew about Judaism, the more one sympathized with Jewish religious doctrines, the more critical one was of the state of Israel.
Well, that's about all that we have time for today. So thank you very much for joining us, Jack.
Thank you, Max. I appreciate it. And I look forward to having additional contact with you down the line.
Fantastic. This has been New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. We've had Jack Jacobs, Professor of Political Science at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, on to talk about his new book, The Frankfurt School, Jewish Lives and Antisemitism, published in 2015 by Cambridge University Press.